Accession number 28462, reel number 5.
A little screen, wasn't it, with a wave across it?
Yes, yes.
And when that peaked.
A bit like early television sets.
Yeah.
But they could go wrong, of course. However, that was another stage in the whole thing. And we did a lot of working up there, various exercises, and on one occasion we were woken up in the middle of the night and told to get out and get torpedoes on and go up to the Shetlands. And I think the rumour had been that the Tirpitz had got out. And looking back, I've got a feeling that we were being kept up there for a possible attack on any of the German fleet which came out from Norway, although it would have been at our extreme range, I should think. Anyway, we flew up to Sumbra in the Shetlands in the most filthy weather imaginable. In fact, we were flying in formation just under the base of the cloud, which was almost down to sea level. Got to Sumbra, to the RAF station there, and were informed that there was to be no service flying. The weather was too bad, so the aircraft were all lashed down, and the RAF were having their monthly party that night, where they sent a bus around to collect all the females on the island, and we had a party. Some party, too. And the next day we flew back to the Orkneys. And very shortly after that... we did our... Yeah, November the 9th, we flew to Arbroath, handed all our aircraft over, took our parachutes in our parachute bags and any clothes we could get in as well on top, which was very, very little. And we went down to Glasgow. We went aboard HMS Royal Sovereign, big battleship. And we were taken in her out to Durban, all the way around the Cape. And we were landed in Durban, where we were put up in a magnificent hotel for about 4 or 5 days, then transferred to a troop ship, which was a new Dutch liner, actually, the New Amsterdam, which had been converted to a troop ship, up to the Red Sea to Port Tewfik, where we were disembarked, and then on to Cairo and Alexandria, where we were going to be stationed.
Good heavens, so from the Orkneys to the Middle East. Mm.
So we left...
What memories of the voyage on this huge battle cruiser? That was the HMS...
Royal Sovereign.
The HMS Royal Sovereign.
Eventually sold to the Chinese. And that's another story. But, we were passengers, really, but we did sort of pay our way because we were used as lookouts, anti-submarine and aircraft lookouts, all the way. We lived with the junior officers in the ship, and we were made very welcome. There was nothing really very sensational about it. We weren't attacked or anything like that. Well, we stopped at Freetown, which was my first view of an African country.
I've been to Freetown. What an extraordinary contrast that must have been from the Orkneys.
Yes, it was a bit warmer.
And the ship was steaming in a convoy, presumably?
No, she was on her own, yeah.
Flat out?
Flat out, yeah. I don't know how far she could go, but I suppose she couldn't have done more than about...
20 knots.
20 knots, I should think, yeah.
And so it would have taken you, what, about three weeks?
Well, from November the 9th, it was January the 31st before I flew again. So it was most of November, December and January. We had about 4 or 5 days in Durban.
Sorry, going back to Freetown, that's quite an interesting...
Yeah.
What, did you go ashore?
I went ashore and went for a walk on the beach, that's all.
And it was there, it was busy with naval activity, I suppose. It was...
it was quite busy. I don't remember a lot of detail about that.
Okay. And then on to Durban, which must have been, again, a huge...
Durban was fantastic, yes. Oh, yes.
I mean, you for a sort of, I mean, an English boy who'd never really travelled anywhere to suddenly
wind
up in this wonderfully exotic...
In a country where I'd had family relatives.
Oh, you did? Again? Yeah.
Well, I hadn't. They weren't there then, but an aunt of mine had spent a lot of time in South Africa.
Oh, I see. So
and an uncle... Well, he wasn't at Durban, but I think he was in Mauritius, actually. He did spend some time in South Africa. So we were put in this hotel, which was really fantastic. And the local people sort of came and took us out for drives in the country and made us feel very welcome.
And having come from Britain in 1941 to this place where there was no rationing, there was no blackout, I imagine.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think the biggest surprise was going into the restaurant to have breakfast, and there was a menu that long. I mean, you could have almost anything you thought of. Fillet steak or egg and bacon or fish or whatever. And that was the story in Durban. It really was an eye-opener.
And so then, you were taken around. Did you meet any of the local military who were based there? Or?
No. We met local civilians, and we were sort of shown around a bit.
Did you know where your final destination would be by this point?
I'm not sure, quite honestly. We were obviously I think we knew we were going to Egypt, but we didn't know very much.
I should have asked
We weren't told very much.
But it was fairly sudden, this sudden
get
down to Glasgow, take minimum kit.
Suddenly, very sudden. And all our main kit followed, in terms of all the rest of my uniform, other belongings. I had to go through all those tropical scenes just in blues. Although in the Royal Sovereign, they did let us have some petty officer shirts and shorts, so we were able to be a bit more comfortable. But in Durban, we really had to wear our proper uniform because, you had to. I mean, that was it.
So then it's back on ship, and then up the other.
Then back to this,
the East Coast.
This troop ship up the East Coast.
Any ports of call there?
No, not till we got to Port Tewfik, where we unloaded. And I remember on that voyage, an army major gave us a lecture about the defence of Singapore and how it was absolutely invincible. And of course, it must have been about that very time that the Japanese decided to invade Malaysia from the north. And we didn't hear about that till a bit later on. But I always remember that, him saying, they can't touch us, we've got guns in all directions, but they hadn't got any guns pointing inland. Terrible story, that.
And what about other aspects of shipboard life? I mean, it was a fairly long time. You were doing watches occasionally, but...
That was in the Royal Sovereign, yes.
Oh, I'm sorry, so from Durban you weren't in the... You transshipped to...
No, we were in a troop ship then.
Oh, of course, you said, the wonderful Dutch...
We just had to buy the time somehow or other. It was almost dry, because they'd been very well stocked. The only liquor they'd got was... not cocktails, the other thing.
Vermouth or...
What do you have after dinner?
Digestif, sort of cognacs and...
Yes, that sort of thing, yeah.
Right.
You couldn't drink too much of that.
Put in on that heat.
Yeah.
So you arrive you debark in Port Tewfik.
Yeah.
And how do you get from there up to Cairo?
We got by train. I was, as the junior officer in the squadron, I was detailed to look after our kit, and I had to sit in a skip and be lifted over the side into a lighter with two senior ratings who were a couple of absolutely magnificent blokes. and we got ashore. And then we'd got to get from there to Cairo and from there to Alexandria. And I don't know whether these two boys had been there before, but they said to me, "Don't you worry, sir, we'll look after that. You carry on." And So I thought, well, I don't know my way around here. I may as well leave it to them. Hope for the best. There were, you know, we had some really good characters like that in the squadron. And so I went into Cairo, and there was somebody we'd met on the way who had given us a phone number. He said, if you're in Cairo, you know, give me a ring. And I thought, well, I've got to find somewhere to sleep tonight. So I rang this chap up, and they said, well, take a taxi to so-and-so. And I stayed in his friend's flat, actually, for the night. And then they put me on the train next morning to Alexandria. And
so you were travelling on your own? You
Yeah.
Yeah.
And eventually I finished up at the Naval Air Station at Dakila, which is just outside Alexandria. And I think that was called Grebe.
What were your impressions of Egypt for the first time? The
train yells,
journey?
Bells and smells. Particularly yells. And
because it was fairly raucous. Both Alexandria and Cairo were pretty...
Yeah, well, I only spent a night in Cairo, and we weren't out on the town. That came later in Alexandria. But Cairo, I had a very quiet night there.
And you took the train down through the Delta. I studied Arabic, you see, at university, so I know Cairo and Alexandria very well.
Oh, you do, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And so you arrive in Alexandria, you go out to your base.
Then I went out to the base, yes, and sure enough, these two chaps with all the luggage, they'd arrived safely.
Intact?
Yep, absolutely. And so we all arrived there, all the flying crews, and then the odd people who had flown with us from Hatstone to our breath. And they didn't know we were coming. I remember the commander coming out and saying, oh, nobody told us you were coming. We've got no aeroplanes for you to fly anyway. There we were. However, there was then a suggestion that we should be converted to Beauforts, which was the RAF twin-engine torpedo bomber, known as the Flying Coffin. And I don't know who got the idea, but anyway, we were sent off to Aboukir, I think, where there was an RAF maintenance unit, where they were rebuilding Blenheims, which had been crashed in the desert, and they'd brought all the bits and pieces in and made some more. And there was a chap there who was a test pilot, he was a warrant officer. What he didn't know about the RAF and flying, you could have written on a postage stamp in large block capitals. And, well, the idea was that we should get some idea of what it was like to fly a twin-engine aeroplane. Well, they had no dual control, of course. This chap took us up. I think we were allowed to just fly it around in the air once or twice. And
well, not a solo. I mean,
No.
Right. It had no dual controls, but it had.
No.
It
had room for. Yeah, because normally the Blenheim crew had pilot, observer, navigator.
Oh, this was the Blenheim. I thought this was the Beaufort you were talking about.
No, the Blenheim. Well, the Beaufort was similar, actually.
I see.
It was. It was a bit of a sort of development of the Blenheim. So, I think they had four or five crews. So how they were going to crew us up, I don't know, because we were only three crew to our aircraft. Anyway, that idea was dropped. And what happened then?
What were your impressions of the Blenheim when you flew it? Well, I suppose it was such a short time.
The main impression was that to get it off the ground, he had to taxi right into one corner, get the tail right into one corner of the airfield, hold the brakes on till the engines were running at full throttle, and then let go. And we just cleared the hedge at the other end by getting the wheels up in time. So it was quite tight, but it was interesting anyway. But anyway, nothing came of that. It's just one of these things that in war there's so much time and effort lost because of one project or another, like all that time we were up at Hatstone. I'm sure we were, if anything had got out, we'd have been sent to attack it, but it didn't, maybe because we were there. So we started doing a bit of flying at Dakila
with using the other
with albacores, albacores and swordfish, mainly albacores.
Albacores. We haven't talked about albacores.
Yes, we did cover albacores. Back at Crail and Arbroath, we were introduced to albacores.
Right.
And did a bit of night flying there.
Yeah, sorry. Sure.
With them.
Sure.
So this was sort of really getting used to flying again after the long break. And then all of a sudden, we were told we were going to ferry some aircraft to Malta.
We're now in spring of 42.
March 42, that's right. And in fact, we were a six crew unit at that time. Our CO was shot down in the desert. Very unfortunate. He was flying an albacore, and when he got to fly them, he said, "Oh, lovely cabin, I can fly in my cap." And he went up to the desert to do a bit of reconnaissance, because we were destined to go up there later on. And he was taking off with his cap on, and so no helmet and no communication with the back. And he had his own air gunner in the back. And as he took off, an 88 came out of the clouds, and he was sitting right in front of it, and they shot him down. So we lost him, which was a real blow at that time, because we'd got to take... they sort of drew a whole lot of odd people together. Most of our squadron, and they pulled two people over from Malta to help with this ferrying job, and there were six albacores and six swordfish to go. The albacores went first, and it was spread over about 5 or 6 weeks. We went in pairs, and each pair had to wait till the previous one had either got there or hadn't got there, and the weather forecast was good, because you've got to take off finally from an advanced landing ground, LADM, where there were practically no facilities at all for hanging about, so you had to be able to go pretty well straight through. Anyway, there were two albacores lost. No, one albacore lost, I think. They had an extra fuel tank in the observer's seat, and at El Adam they had to be filled by hand, topped up. And, of course, they topped them up till they overflowed. So you've got a hell of a smell of petrol in the back cockpit. And one of the things that we were all told was, you need to get in WT touch with Malta at the earliest possible opportunity. Now, one of the albacores was seen to go down in flames, and if it wasn't a night fighter, we thought probably what had happened, that the observer tried to use the radio before the petrol fumes had gone, and there was a spark, and that was it. And we lost a swordfish doing that as well. I was in the last pair to go, so I was hanging about for weeks, sort of wondering how it was all going to go. I was very lucky, though, because there was another pair, another one with us. The pilot of that had been flying from Malta for quite a long time. The observer who came over from Malta and flew with me had also been flying from Malta. He was a New Zealand radio engineer, which was a big advantage, because if anything went wrong with our radios, he could put it right. And the radio, the WT contact was vital. And the other observer was somebody I'd been flying with quite a lot, who, funnily enough, joined our squadron in a hat in the Orkneys. And about 2 or 3 weeks after he joined, I realised that we'd been at the same prep school. He'd lived down the road from us, and used to come and play in our garden. Anyway, he was the other observer. And we got the word to go. We left Alexandria, and we flew to Sidi Barani, where we had lunch and topped the tanks up. That was 2 hours 30. And then from there, that was on March the 10th, to El Adam, which was 1 hour 45, where we topped the tanks up as well and had a supper of bully beef and pickled onions and highly chlorinated tea.
And this was just a sort of tented, a little tented area?
It was a cave.
Really?
There were no ground buildings, no tents. You climbed down a vertical ladder into a cave, which was the operations room and the mess and everything else.
And why was it underground, so it wouldn't be spotted?
Yes, because it was a forward landing ground and it was liable to be raided.
You were quite close to the front line, I imagine.
We were fairly, yes. I don't know how close it was then, because the front line tended to move around quite a bit. So that was El Adam. And we topped up there again and took off for Malta. It was just about dusk when we took off. I remember seeing all the tanks on the ground with their bivouac fires and thinking, well, it looks rather comfortable down there, I must say. Mind you, it wasn't when it came to it. They came to their battles. And we had 7.25 hours to Malta.
So overnight?
Overnight, yes.
Over the sea?
We took... it's all over the sea, yeah.
Of course.
And we had actually... We knew we were going to fly together. We'd practiced flying in formation. We'd practiced even flying wind-finding in formation at night in case one WT set broke down, so we had to stay together. And
sorry, I didn't... I don't understand that.
When you're on any length of flight over the sea and you need to check the wind direction, you drop a smoke float and you steer a steady course from that while the observer takes bearings, and you steer another course, and he can then work out what drift you've got or where the wind is and how strong it is. So we had to be prepared to do that. But in fact, our estimated time of that flight was 7.75 hours, but we got a tailwind, which speeded things up a bit, which was good because... at that time, Malta was being bombed fairly continuously, and we had been warned that we might have to stand off for up to half an hour if there was an air raid on. And but it was all right, actually, because we got this tailwind. We got in a bit earlier.
What kind of margins would you have had?
We would have had a good hour.
So you had enough fuel for 8.5 hours, and the flight was 7:15.
I think certainly we had enough for 8.5 hours. Yeah.
But it must have been with some trepidation that you took off on this.
Well, a certain amount, yes. It was a long flight, and we knew that everybody hadn't got there.
And these tanks were gravity fed. You had to switch from one to the other, presumably.
Yeah, yeah.
Where did the Swordfish auxiliary fuel tank?
Well, on that flight, we had a tank slung underneath, which was where you'd normally carry a torpedo or a mine, and a tank in the back as well. So you had to... I forget quite how we did it. I think we used the fuel from the tank slung underneath first. So you had to switch from one to the other, yes.
And that was pumped up to the engine? Must have been, I imagine.
Well, it must have been from the lower tank, yes. Normally they were gravity feed. So they must have had... I can't remember that detail, actually, except that it took a long time. However, thanks to our excellent navigators, we did, in fact, part company in cloud. but we both landed right on the spot. We hit Malta absolutely, because it was a very small island to hit after 7.5 hours flying. But the navigation had been good, the course flying had been good, and we were right... hit the target right on. And fortunately, there was no air raid.
Dawn or just before dawn?
It was before dawn. It was still dark, yes.
But you could see it coming out of the...
You could see enough, yes. You could see the shadow of it. And fortunately, there was no air raid on, so we went straight in and landed. And they were very glad to see us because they were so short of aircraft. But those two aircraft, two nights later, collided on the ground. In the middle of an air raid, they were taking off. One was on the beginning of the flare path when the air raid started, and those pilots were so used to flying from there, they could fly without a flare path. The chap on the beginning of the flare path decided he would go. The other one was taxiing across to get into position to take off, and they collided.
And were they injured?
Fortunately, there were no injuries, but both aircraft were written off. And 3 weeks later, they'd built one new aeroplane out of those two. So all that effort, all that cost and expense and organisation could be written off just like that. But that's war.
So here you are now. You're now in Malta, and that was at the height of the Maltese, April 42, I think, was the time they had their worst raids.
That's right.
We were on a recent visit there. Practically every night they were a colossal amount.
And all day, too.
Yeah.
We spent most of the time on the top of the steps to an air raid shelter, and when we saw the bombs falling, we just went underneath. There was nothing else we could do.
And where was that? Where were you billeted?
We were billeted in Califrana, which was the old RAF seaplane base. And there was a bay there. I've forgotten the name of it now. But while we were there, a ship called the Breconshire, which had been on a Malta convoy, managed to limp in there and sank. And one of our party said, you know, they're going to bomb that any minute now. We ought to go for a long walk. So we did. It was one afternoon. And eventually we said, well, we better start back now. We'll miss tea. And on our way back, there was a Stuka attack. And there was practically no opposition to it because there was hardly any ammunition. And there were 12 or 15 Stukas dived on the ship and they didn't even hit it. Not one hit. And when I went back to Malta, 7, 8 months later, I bought a tin of naval tobacco, which was all rusty. It had been in the ship. The tobacco was all right. The tin was a bit rusty.
Enterprising Maltese had swum down.
They did salvage quite a lot of its cargo, but not nearly enough.
How long were you then in Malta?
Well, we were there a fortnight.
And what was your impression of being in Malta at that time? It's a particularly interesting time because it was at the peak, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, there wasn't much we could really do because we had to take shelter most of the time. I'm sure we didn't actually go into any of the towns or go out and about at all. We just sort of waited, and we had to be on the spot in case there was an aircraft that could take us back to Egypt.
I see.
Which eventually there was, a Wellington, being flown out to the Middle East by a brand new crew. We took off, and when it was getting light, the pilot suddenly slowed down and put his wheels down. And fortunately, one of the observers, who'd done a lot of flying from Malta, said, what the hell's he doing? And went up to the pilot and said, what's going on, mate? Oh, he said, well, we'll be able to land soon. There's Africa. He said, that's not Africa. That's Rommel's country there. For God's sake, get the wheels up and get out to sea again. Which he did. We were probably 3 hours away from Alexandria. So anyway, that came off safely and we all got back.
Actually, all right for the moment. Do you want to stop?
Do you want to change over?
No, I'm doing fine. I think we've got another half reel. Anyway, we'll press on. So this is Ian Templer, reel 6.
Yeah.